This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. South Beach, Weight Watchers, Atkins, weight loss programs abound. Deborah Sullivan knows this well. She is a dietitian at Kansas University, and she just completed a small pilot study to find out whether the virtual reality computer game, Second Life, could help people lose weight in real life. Her results were promising, and she has secured a grant to continue exploring the question. We talked about how acting out a virtual weight loss regimen could translate into real change.
In real life, you know, in our traditional state-of-the-art weight loss clinics, we have people come in to a group weight loss clinic weekly. We teach them the behaviors they need to do in order to lose weight. And then we ask them to go out into the real world. And the advantage of Second Life is you can go to the grocery store 24 hours a day. You could go to the restaurant and, you know, for example, if you pick the appetizer, spinach artichoke dip, you would click on that food item and get the calorie content, but then also a little tagline, you know, don't let the name fool you. This is not a vegetable. A better choice would be X.
Your study found that Second Life was more effective for some people than programs in person or on the phone, especially with the maintenance part of all of this. Why is that?
Well, we think it's because, you know, for weight loss, it doesn't matter what diet you're doing. If you follow the diet, you're going to be successful and lose weight. It's when you stop that rigid plan, that's when the weight begins to creep back. And so we believe that the behaviors they were able to practice in Second Life translated better compared to our traditional face-to-face group.
What about exercise? Do you take that into account in the Second Life program?
Oh, very much so. Exercise is a core component. We do have a gymnasium. We now have a pool. We have walking paths. We have all sorts of behaviors that you can do in real life. And while I know it might seem silly to think that my avatar is running on a treadmill in my virtual reality, you know, a lot of people that are overweight are not comfortable going into a gym. They've never used a treadmill. Their avatar doing those things in Second Life, we believe, does inspire them to do those activities in real life.
Deborah Sullivan, she is a dietitian at Kansas University Medical Center. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
And it's time for sports. NPR's Mike Pesca is on the line from New York. Good morning, Mike.
Hey.
There's a little wrestling news to talk about this morning. There was this big landmark wrestling match last week between Iran and the U.S. It took place in Grand Central Station, right?
Grand Central, yeah, I was there. The Russians were involved, too. Quite
exciting. Very exciting. Yep. There was supposed to be a rematch between the Iranians and the U.S. in L.A. today. It is not going to happen.
No, the Iranians pulled out. They got the Russians and Canadians to fill their slot. That will not thrill the, you know, few thousand Persian Americans who already bought tickets, but what can you do?
Oops. Okay, but I understand there's actually a larger story about wrestling in the ether right now.
Yeah, a huge story that's going to have an effect on its future. You know, in the they'll be wrestling in the next Olympics. Wrestling's been in every Olympics since they started them. There was in 1900, there was no wrestling, but you know, wrestling in the marathon, the most important Olympic sports, but they voted out wrestling in 2020. In 2024, there's a chance for the sport itself to work its way back in. They have to win a couple of international votes, but yes, wrestling, let's go with the pun, is on the mat.
Oh, okay. So they are trying to make some changes to make sure they can participate. What are they floating as possibilities?
Right. So the first reaction was indignant and how could this happen? And, you know, the countries like Iran and the U.S. and Russia, they were very upset and they mobilized their forces like in politics. The base was upset. But they also know they have to do some outreach and they also know they have to change a little bit. So some of the things they're talking about are things like maybe we should change. There's no reason it has to be a circular mat. They've been talking to the MMA guys. MMA has an octagon.
This is the martial arts people.
Mixed martial arts. Maybe wrestling could scrap those singlets, the, you know, onesies that they use, and just wrestle in shorts or a t-shirt. And then even the scoring, now it's best 2 out of 3. There are 3 periods. So maybe wrestling could go in for aggregate scores. So you don't just win periods. Whoever wins on the most points would win. That's a change they're considering.
What about making those changes would endear the sport to more people or convince
right.
the Olympic Committee that they should let wrestling back in?
Well, the first couple I mentioned, that's just this clear showmanship, perhaps versus sportsmanship issue. But then when you go with the scoring, a lot of the wrestling wrestlers I talk to think it would be more exciting to have the score be an aggregate, because this way, you know, there's tension at the very end. It's not the case that some guy just won two rounds. It could all come down to the final seconds. I mean, most of the wrestlers think that this would be a bit more exciting, and that's what they're going for.
Well, I'm excited just thinking about it. NPR's Mike Pesca in New York. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News. American institutions, from government to Wall Street to small-town Rotary clubs, have broken down. That's what journalist George Packer says in a new book. It's called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he often covers the political scene. His book, The Assassin's Gate, took him to the streets of Baghdad in the middle of the Iraq War. But Packer's new book looks at the last few turbulent decades of life here in America and profiles some of the most famous and successful Americans, as well as people you've probably never heard of: a community organizer, a local entrepreneur, a disenchanted Washington lobbyist. Packer weaves these profiles together to tell a larger story about this moment in America, a moment, he says, in which the country has lost something vital.
I think of it as a deal that used to exist among Americans, a deal that maybe lasted half a century, from the 30s to the late 70s, in which everyone had a place. People were more constrained than they are today. They had less freedom, but they had more security. And there was a sense in which each generation felt that the next generation would be able to improve itself, to do better, and that there were channels of opportunity, education, jobs, that would allow people's children to rise. And I think over the last generation, that deal has come undone. And instead, many Americans feel that they're all alone, that no one is going to help them, and that in a way, there's a kind of unfairness at play in our society where elites seem to do better and better, and ordinary people who might have once even thought of themselves as middle class struggle more and more. That's what's unwound in my adult lifetime.
You just outlined a pretty dire situation. Did you start to hone in on this theme, this idea of an unwinding, purely from the financial institution meltdown of 2008, or was there something else that you were seeing that led you to this place?
You know, I think it began with the Iraq War. I covered Iraq for The New Yorker. I wrote a book about it. And I'd begun by seeing that war as a failure of individual leaders. But over time, I saw that whole institutions were failing. The military at the beginning of the war failed. Intelligence, the media failed. And then the financial crisis made it seem as if there was something epical going on. And that's when I began to think, how would I write about a country that is watching its core institutions collapse? I wanted to do it as a narrative. I wanted to pull together stories of Americans whose lives have kind of moved to the pulse of this recent history. And so I went about the country trying to find people whose stories fit in with that larger narrative.
Which you do. You include a wide variety of vignettes and profiles of Americans. Some of them are famous: Newt Gingrich, Oprah Winfrey. But you also write about people who are just Americans. One character in particular, a woman named Tammy Thomas. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, Tammy was born, raised, and still lives in Youngstown, Ohio. She's African American. She grew up during a time when Youngstown was a steel town, and it was a union town. But around the time she was a teenager, the steel mills just collapsed one after another in rapid succession. And Youngstown collapsed with them so quickly that it became a kind of icon of deindustrialization. And I spent a lot of time with Tammy driving around the city, looking at the landmarks of her life and hearing her story, which was an incredible story of a woman who, her mother was a heroin addict. She was not close to her father. She had three children without their fathers really being in their lives. But she got a job in an auto parts factory, and that allowed her to raise the kids and to hold herself and them together amid an absolutely disastrous situation in Youngstown. And then, around the time of the financial crisis and the election of Barack Obama, having lost her job because the auto parts factory went bankrupt, she remade herself as a community organizer, and that's what she's doing now. She has not given up on Youngstown, and I think even though these institutions are collapsing and people do feel they're on their own, the individuals in the book, people like Tammy and Dean Price, who maybe we can talk about from North Carolina, there's a resilience and even an optimism that's kind of remarkable given what's going on around them.
You mentioned Dean Price. He's from North Carolina, tobacco country. How does his story fit into the larger narrative that you're telling?
Well, I've never been anywhere that felt so old and so traditionally American as the Carolina Piedmont, which is the region that Dean comes from. It's tobacco country. There used to be textiles and furniture making. And then tobacco, as we know, fell with the 90s and the investigations and the tobacco buyout. And it kind of laid waste to what had been a very intact middle class and working class part of the country. Dean Price is a son of that region. His father was a Bible Belt preacher. His whole family had been tobacco farmers since the 18th century. They all lived within about 10 miles of each other in Rockingham County, North Carolina. And again, around the time of the financial crisis, Dean, who had this truck stop business, watched his business fail, so he turned to biofuels. And he has this whole vision, which I think is a very American vision, of a resurgence, a kind of renaissance of the countryside through alternative energy. But he's doing it on his own. No one is telling him to. There's no organization he's part of. There's no union or business trade association or newspaper that he's connected. He's a loner out there. He's a Johnny Appleseed spreading biodiesel across the countryside.
But I could imagine some people would say, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what America's about. You articulate a dream, a goal, and you go do it. And sometimes you have to do it alone.
That's true. It's a very deep American dream. It's not the only American dream. There's also a dream of being part of a community. And it's the dissolution of these communities that's so painful to see. Because as Dean said to me while we were walking around Madison, North Carolina, the town that he grew up in, the shoe store was closed down. The pharmacy was shuttered. The restaurants were closed. There were just a couple people on the sidewalk. You see this in little towns all across the heartland. He said the guys who used to own those stores were the pillars of this community. They coached the Little League teams. They were on the town council. They're gone. And communities can't suffer that way without great consequences.
Is this just another part of a cycle, or is this unwinding as you see it different?
In some ways, it is cyclical. I think we've been through it many times before. So I don't want to say this is it. You know, we'll never come back from this. We've come back before. We often come back stronger. What I see happening is not just cyclical, though. It feels like a real cultural shift where the value of the community, of what makes this a coherent society, has really been submerged. And it's not all dark. We've been talking as if it's a completely dismal picture. But what isn't dark is the energy and the vitality and the humor and the dreams, as well as the screw-ups and the setbacks of the characters in the book. When I stop thinking about the big picture and institutions and leaders and I think about these people who I got to know so well, they still give me hope.
The book is called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. George Packer joined us in our studios in Washington. Thank you so much, George.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden, and it's time now for music.
Oh, you're an alien. Your touch so foreign. It's supernatural. It's extraterrestrial.
That's the group Pentatonix, winners of NBC's hit reality show competition, The Sing-Off, singing their a cappella version of Katy Perry's E.T. The days of doo-wops and barbershop may be gone, but a cappella is cool again. And it's all thanks to the father of contemporary a cappella, Deke Sharon. Sharon is vocal producer for The Sing-Off and the movie that brought a cappella to the big screen, Pitch Perfect. A cappella may mean performing without instruments, but in my conversation with Deke Sharon, he played a few.
A little muted trumpet. Little electric guitar.
You are phenomenal. I mean, I have this vision of you as a kid in the bedroom with this stuff, and I just want to say, where does it all come from?
Well, it is easy to say I was the kid in the back of the class making funny noises like Robin Williams, but I was actually the kid sitting in the front row, snotty and sucking up to the teacher. So these all of these sounds were developed slowly over time. I think all people who sing a cappella sing along with the radio, but they don't sing the melody. They sing the harmony, and then they start singing the guitar part, and they start making up drum sounds. And before you know it, there's no turning back.
With the success of your movie Pitch Perfect and the a cappella reality show, The Sing-Off, coming back for the fourth season, these kinds of groups have really found a whole new audience in recent years, haven't they?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, a cappella is the oldest music. And back 100 years ago, barbershop, that was just guys getting together singing current pop music. 50 years ago, doo-wop, the street corner thing, they were just singing current pop tunes. So what we're doing now is no different. The real difference is that we're able to use our voices in a number of new ways that are able to fill out the sound and really replicate the strong pounding rhythms and the full sonic spectrum, replicating instruments sometimes. Back in the day when the Whiff and Poofs were started at Yale, collegiate a cappella was four-part singing. Now, if you've got 14 guys, you're going to have 14 different parts sometimes, and you can really replicate a current pop song, which is electrifying for an audience.
What about for you? Where did it catch fire?
For me, it was experiential. Some of it came from singing around the campfire and hearing one of the counselors improvise harmonies. When the Tufts Beelzebubs came and sang at my high school, I was captivated. I just loved the energy and the excitement of the sound that came from them on stage. But when I was in college and I started directing the Tufts Beelzebubs, I wanted to sing the current pop songs on the radio. And it just didn't work with shooby-doo-wop and ooh and ah and lyrics. So we needed to add the vocal percussion, and we needed to create different instrumental sounds to make that come alive and work for the audiences. And then we were off to the races.
You know what I was thinking in your movie, Pitch Perfect? I'm looking at the riff-off. 'Cause I may be bad, but I'm perfectly good at it. And I'm thinking, as the women are singing, that it's, maybe this is crazy, sort of a female updated version of The Sharks and the Jets. I mean, I hear in my brain something that links back to West Side Story, only this time everybody's singing, and they're chicks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the excitement of that scene, although, frankly, it's almost impossible to do live. I'll let you know that you shouldn't be expecting collegiate a cappella groups to be doing that in empty swimming pools around the nation spontaneously. But the drama of that scene comes from the fact that you don't expect women to be singing this kind of full, rich, powerful a cappella. That's one of the things that contemporary a cappella has really brought to the forefront, having women be every bit the counterpart of men.
You were the vocal producer for Pitch Perfect, and you helped arrange this song. Let's listen to the Bellas sing here.
I'll be alone, dancing, you know it, baby. Tell me your troubles and doubts, giving me everything inside and out. Don't you forget about me as you walk on by.
I've been singing this all day now.
You and 13-year-old girls around the world.
Oh, there's a lot of 13-year-old girls in there. I understand you had nine actresses for this performance, and some of them had never sung a cappella before. Tell me how you rehearsed them for this movie.
That's correct. Well, we had set aside, Jason Moore, the fantastic director of this movie, set aside a month of a cappella boot camp, he called it. And so I got together on that first day. We had one singer, Kelly Jekyll, who was in two seasons of The Sing-Off as our kind of ringer. And then nine actresses, most of whom had maybe had a little bit of, I sang in chorus in middle school. Let me tell you, after that first day, I went home and I didn't sleep too much. I thought, can we do this? Is this going to be possible? But they really stepped up. I mean, Shelley, who did vocal percussion, there was nobody who had done any. And I just had to ask, so who wants to learn how to beatbox? And she kind of sheepishly raised her hand. I was like, okay, let's do this. Let's go. And we just put them all on a crash course and they really rose to the occasion.
So this is the percussion we're hearing, because people people might be thinking, oh, they've added some drums or something like that. No, mm-mm. This is absolutely mm-mm. things you're doing with your mouth. Can you teach me how to beatbox?
Well, yeah, I'll give you a little bit. The easiest one is a hi-hat. It's just a T sound. Just say t, 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 like that. Perfect. Keep doing it. So you can use an open hi-hat sound, but breathe in. Do you hear the difference?
Yeah, like the little hi-hat.
Right, so you can go. Exactly. And then kick drums underneath that. You could say boots and cats and boots and cats, but then turn that into.
Boots and cats, boots. And then it turns into.
Boots and cats, boots and cats. There you go. There you go. Day one. You're ready for a cappella boot camp. Done.
Wow. This is so much fun. You know, there had to be a time, though, when if you told your friends that this is what you wanted to do, I can just imagine it landing just with a huge thud, you know.
Huge thud. In fact, my high school choral director wouldn't say this to my face, but I learned afterwards. He said, basically, you graduated college, and it's as though you said, I love tiddlywinks, so I want to create a professional tiddlywink circuit and tiddlywink competitions, tiddlywink nonprofit. And then 10 years later, he said, I guess it worked out for you in the tiddlywinks thing. So I bet my life, a huge risk, and it has paid off handsomely and been a wonderful journey. You got it.
Just think about
Done.
That, okay?
Done. Just get a couple of your friends together, and I'll see you in New York this weekend for casting.
The All Things Considered Weekend a cappella group. I think we can work on that. Deke Sharon, it has been so much fun to talk to you. Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Boots and Cats, our program, is directed today by Becky Hersher. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Lily Percy, Amy Held, Liz Baker, Becky Sullivan, and Connor Donovan. Our intern is Rachel Rood. Our weekend web producers are Melissa Goh, Stephanie Federico, Krishnadev Cullimore, and Dana Farrington. Technical director is Daniel Shukin. At the operations desk, Tom Woodward. Our reference librarian is Kim Oleski. Mathoni Maturi, senior editor, and Steve Lichtai, the senior producer. And for Sunday, that's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Check out our podcast. Find it at npr.org/weekendatc or on the NPR smartphone app. It's called Weekends on All Things Considered, or follow me on Twitter at NPR Jackie Leiden. We're back on the radio next weekend. Until then, thanks for listening and have a great week. I make you feel right, baby. Can't promise tomorrow, but I promise tonight, darling. Communications barriers have long vexed us, as showcased in the movie Rush Hour.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Scientists in the 17th century were working hard to understand, namely, the secrets of the universe, but also each other. With Latin on the decline, they were seeking a whole new way of communicating that would defy barriers and borders, a universal language. And though he's better known for discovering gravity, even Sir Isaac Newton took a stab at it. We know this because Newton left behind an outline of this new universal language in an old notebook. Erica Okrent is an editor-at-large at TheWeek.com, and she's also a linguist who explains how this language would work.
What Newton tried out was you didn't have to have different words for every degree of something. You could have one root. And the example he gives is tor for temperature. And then to make the word cold, you just add a prefix to it. And to make the word hot, you add a different prefix to it. And then you have different prefixes all the way through the whole scale of coldness to hotness. So utor is hot, autor is exceedingly hot, etor is warm, oitor is excessively cold, and everything in between. So you could have a degree of precision of temperature just by adding these set prefixes to that one concept.
So have you tried to speak in Sir Isaac Newton's language?
Well, he doesn't give enough vocabulary for you to really say anything. He just gives a few examples. The rest of it is all an outline of how it could work. And I think that's where many people got tripped up on this idea. It sounds really nice. Break down the universe into concepts and make a mathematics out of that. And then you have to sit down and figure out the universe. And that part's a lot harder. But a colleague of his, John Wilkins, a member of the Royal Society, actually did this and has a 600-page breakdown of a vocabulary based on everything in the universe. It was very well known in its day, and no one ever really spoke it.
So why did this bid at trying to create this universal language fail?
Well, it's nice to think that we could overcome misunderstandings if we could be so precise that exactly what we wanted to say would come through, and that and the person on the other end could decompose our meaning perfectly. There's no fuzziness in there. But that isn't the way that we use language. The fuzziness and ambiguity in language is actually very useful to us. We go ahead, we start talking without really knowing where we're going. We work out our thoughts as we speak, and it's hard to do that in a language where you have to know your exact meaning before you can even say anything.
So Newtonian didn't count for, in Arabic, you say yani a lot, and in English, whatever.
Right. You need the whatever. You want to be able to say it's hot or it's cold without specifying it's very little exceedingly hot.
You know, this whole attempt to create a new language, I mean, it's always a wonderful concept. I remember Esperanto was going to be the universal language in the 60s. Why don't universal languages catch on very well?
I mean, Esperanto is the most successful one of all time in the sense that it's not a universal language, but people actually still speak it. But they do within their own little community. And I think that's the real problem. We can't have a universal language because we don't have a universal community. And that's where languages live, between people.
That's Erica Okrent, editor-at-large for TheWeek.com and the author of In the Land of Invented Languages. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. This was fun.